entry of getting into the field. But there's a lot of young people that are kind of different, that are super, super good at raising animals.
So, listeners, we have been talking to Dr. Temple Grandin, and her website, grandin.com, is fascinating and filled with tons of information. And it's been just a real joy to be talking with you today, Temple. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we appreciate everything that Rootstock Radio puts out there on the airwaves so that we can bring them to you, our listeners here at WEFT Champaign. Listen to Rootstock Radio every Monday at 5:30 p.m. on WEFT Community Radio. Coming up next is In the Know, a WEFT-produced public affairs show that highlights locally available resources. Stay with us after that for Champaign-Urbana Radio Theater at 7, Monday Night R&R at 8, live local music on WEF Sessions at 10, and recorded local music on Champaign Local 901 at 11. And we'll get to some brief underwriting, and then we'll get to this week's edition of In the Know.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and the Living Yoga Center. Established in 1995, the Living Yoga Center offers yoga classes, educational opportunities, and services that promote a healthy, balanced, and spiritual lifestyle. The Sanctuary, located at 212 South 1st Street in Midtown Champaign, is a place for people of all skill levels to learn and experience yoga and other practices that nourish the body, mind, and spirit. The Living Yoga Center supports local charitable causes and nonprofits like community radio station WEFT 90.1 FM. More information is available on Facebook and their website, livingyogacenter.net.
And we do appreciate all of our local community partners slash underwriters and all of our listeners. We are 100% volunteer-operated, community-supported, listener-supported radio for East Central Illinois. Unfortunately, we are going to have a pre-recorded version of In the Know tonight. Your usual hostess, Sherry Williamson, is definitely under the weather. She asked me to put on a replay of her October 16th edition of the show, which deals with domestic violence and sexual assault. Both issues are in the headlines today, as they should be. So we're going to get right to that episode now. And again, if you hear any references to dates and times, this show is from about 6 weeks ago.
Exciting and hopeful to me to see how many people are involved in
R&R at 8, live local music on WEF Sessions at 10, and recorded local music on Champaign Local 901 at 11. We're going to catch us up underwriting real quick, and then we will get to In the Know.
WEF. And again, we've already had underwriting, so we'll skip that portion.
Tonight, for here via Twitter at Nature79. This evening, we'll be having a candid discussion on sexual assault and domestic violence. We have five guests tonight, four here in the studio that you can see on our live stream, and then one on the phone. I'm going to have everybody introduce themselves. We're going to start over here with Tom.
Hi, my name is Tom Miebach. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I'm currently working as a counselor at the University of Illinois Counseling Center, and I have a background in mental health crisis intervention in this town.
Hi, my name is Emily Varnum. I am a clinical counselor at the University of Illinois Counseling Center, and I primarily do work with trauma and trauma response.
I'm Lisa Little. I'm the lead court advocate for Courage Connection, the local domestic violence program. I also am a role player with Police Training Institute, doing acting as the victim in scenarios for sexual assault and domestic violence.
And hi, I'm Marella McMurray. I work at Courage Connection as well, and I am the program manager for our emergency services, and I have a lot of experience working with victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and victims of trauma in general.
Okay, and calling in from D.C., we have Kate. If you can introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Kate Ranta. I'm a domestic and gun violence survivor and a co-founder of Women Against the Violence Epidemic.
Wonderful. Thank you for everybody for being here tonight to discuss these two really important topics. You know, like I've said on previous shows, a lot of what I want to be able to do is dispel myths and misconceptions that people have when you're just looking at headlines and you're just looking at what the media portrays when it comes to different topics. So like always, we're going to jump right in. Kind of want to get everybody's definition on what each of these topics can be defined at. We'll start with sexual assault. When you're discussing this with other people, how do you define sexual assault? We'll start over here with Courage Connection.
We usually define a sexual assault or rape as unwanted physical contact in what we explain to children, especially in their private places, places that you don't want people to touch, your breast, your genital area, and your bottom. However, it can also be just touching someone without their consent, constantly hugging someone, making comments about them. There's a difference between sexual assault and sexual harassment, but sexual assault tends to involve, in our definition, some type of contact.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Nothing to add. In our work, we emphasize the lack of consent and the unwanted touch as well.
Mm-hmm. So what are typically when you're, I think, again, when people are thinking of victims of sexual assault, they look at what the media portrays, somebody who looks like they've been, you know, run over by a semi. That's not always what we're seeing. So when you're dealing with clients, what are the signs that you see of this type of trauma?
So I would say that there's no real one way that anybody looks when they experience a trauma, that individuals who experience trauma can experience a wide range of symptoms. They can feel things like panic. They can experience fear. They could experience just wanting to kind of move on from their situation. That there's no really right way to experience or react to a trauma, that each person's own reactions are right in themselves. So those are things that we kind of emphasize, is that each person's reaction is the right reaction for them.
Okay.
The one thing that I would add to that is, regardless of how the person's behaving, especially in a sexual assault, our first step is to believe what they're telling us, not to question why or what did they do, but just to acknowledge that what they are telling us is actually what happened. We also have had clients who are giddy, who are laughing, which seems totally inappropriate to trauma, but it's very normal to have any range of reactions.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of looking at the reaction, look at what they're telling you.
Right. So the coping mechanism they use doesn't have to necessarily be what you would think would fit a trauma situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. And importantly, especially when it comes to something like this, validating, like you said, what they're saying so that they recognize that they're being taken seriously, because I think that is one of the concerns we have as a society, is when somebody, as they say, screams rape, which I think is a very impersonal way of describing this. You know, this isn't somebody who it's, you know, Chicken Little saying the sky is falling. This is something that has happened to them that, you know, even though we've kind of put more of a uniform definition on it, even individual definition of what sexual assault is, you're saying this is what happened, this is why it made me uncomfortable, and then you're showing how you're working through that. So definitely lots of myths around sexual assault. One, that sexual assault, rape, is not about sex. A lot of people think that this is just somebody who's sexually energized, or you have a couple who it's gone too far and now it's escalated to a place that maybe the other person isn't comfortable with. So when people focus on this idea that it's just about sex, how do you explain to them that it's not?
Well, I do think it's true, and it's an important distinction to point out that oftentimes sexual assaults are more about control and power, and the sensation of exerting power over someone else that's perceived as weaker. We know that does seem to be a commonality in the mind frame of those who perpetrate. And I think to define it as more about sex sort of misses the point and kind of creates a discussion that takes us in a different direction, that misses the actual content that we need to be discussing, which is that these assaults are taking place, that individuals are being overpowered,
mm-hmm.
and that's a great source of the trauma involved.
I agree. However, I would caution using the word overpower only because it doesn't have to be physical. Coercion can be done verbally, through alcohol, through drugs, through any number of means. It could also be a feeling of intimidation that I feel if I don't go through, something bad's going to happen to me. And there is no real threat, but that feeling that I have to do this to get out of this situation, that giving in because I have no other means. So while there are times when the actual physical overpowering certainly happens, we also need to recognize that many, many people never have bruises, mm-hmm. scars, physical scars. They have emotional scars. And there's usually no genital trauma, where they often think there bystanders believe that there has to be some type of physical trauma, that she had to have fought back or it has to be a physical assault. Sometimes victims freeze. They don't move, and there is no physical trauma, but the rape definitely took place.
So one of the other myths that I found, because there's a lot of myths. When you look this up, there are so many myths. One says a victim has to say no for it to be sexual assault. And so what you're explaining is that's not the case. It doesn't have to be something where there's any type of verbal interaction for this to be considered, you know, sexual assault. You were going to...
Yeah, so one of the things that we often talk about with students on campus is talking about what consent is, and that the absence of consent could indicate that a sexual assault happened, and that consent has to be verbal. It has to be mutual, so both parties have to agree. It has to be sober, and it has to be continuous throughout the act. And that if somebody is underage, if somebody is incapacitated, if somebody is asleep, they cannot give consent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think one of the other myths kind of along that line, especially the point of saying that it has to be continuous throughout the act, is sexual arousal means nothing happened. So if somebody... their body physically responds to what's going on, that automatically means, well, you're consenting. But I think we've recognized that what our body does is not always necessarily what our mind is saying. And even if that's happening and somebody isn't verbalizing a no, if somebody is not getting, you know, express consent, that this is still sexual assault. So why do you think people go along with this idea that, well, physically they responded, so that automatically means I had the right to do, you know, what I had started to do, even if somewhere through the act they changed their mind?
My opinion would be that we've often looked at sexual arousal as being something we have control over, especially women, men maybe a little less, especially when you talk about teenagers. However, in many ways, just, you know, stroking, moving, doing some type of physical action to the genitals can cause your body to respond. But we've been conditioned to believe that you respond because you want to, mm-hmm. not because that's a physiological response to stimulation. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, your heartbeat increasing because you're exercising or you're scared or whatever's going on. But we don't talk very often about the separation between desire and actual physiological responses of our bodies. Mm-hmm. And that maybe that's something we need to look into when we do talk about sexual education.
Mm-hmm. So I know that, you know, commonly we're always talking about how sexual assault, rape only happens to women. But it is something that we can see that happens to men, and kind of along the same lines, it's this idea that, well, it couldn't have been something that he wasn't consenting to because his body physically responded mm-hmm. to what I was doing. And so, you know, if you have had, you know, any interactions with, you know, male survivors of this, what I've heard is that there's kind of even a greater level of shame than what you mm-hmm. see because their body responded. So they feel like, well, somehow I was leading them on. So what do you tell victims who, you know, women also carry guilt and shame as well, but what do you say to a man? Because I think there's also other stigma being a male survivor of this because men are supposed to be macho and be able to, you know, fend off whatever happens to them.
Well, I think that's true. And I do think there is perhaps an additional layer of shame because of the masculinity roles that many of us are taught, who are boys, that I shouldn't have let this happen, or I can't share this with someone because I'm a male and no one's going to care. While I think that across genders, there's components of that, but I do think it can be true, especially for males who are victims, that they just feel they don't have a place to talk about this. They don't have anywhere to be understood because men can't be victims in that way. I think that attitude is out there.
And I think generally when working with victims, the two things that I and many of the people at Courage Connection, you know, follow are, first of all, like Lisa said earlier, always start by believing the victim and verbalizing that to them, regardless of gender or ability, and also then letting them know that it's not their fault and that you believe that it happened to them and that it's not their fault. And I think that's a good place to start with anybody, regardless of what their gender may be.
Mm-hmm. One other layer often with men is that they are often sexually assaulted by another man. And many of the perpetrators of that are self-identified as heterosexual. And many of the victims are also heterosexual. So they also have this other layer of, does this mean I'm gay because I physically reacted? And a misunderstanding from the community, if somebody, a man comes and says, a man raped me, well, you got excited about it, so obviously. When that's not true at all. That's, again, our bodies physically reacting regardless of our fear, trauma, and lack of desire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one component that people don't always consider is that you know, it doesn't have to be a woman sexually assaulting a man. It can be a man sexually assaulting another man. And then, of course, you bring into this whole other realm of, well, is this person questioning? Do they not realize what their true sexuality is? When that actually has nothing to do with what's going on. So I could see why that, you know, like Tom was saying, that could be a reason why, you know, male victims don't disclose, because who's going to believe them? And then what, you know, can of worms this is open with disclosing that another man sexually assaulted them. So I think it's already hard for victims to, you know, have that safe space to disclose to anyone, let alone report it. And so now you add all of these other layers of stigma that could possibly come in to play when, you know, the victim is trying to really figure out how to deal with what just happened. Now they have to figure out all of these other things of the what if and who's going to think this and all of that. So, you know, victim blaming is a term that you hear quite a bit. It's with sexual assault, it's with domestic violence, you know, coulda, shoulda, woulda. And so one of the myths that's out there is, you know, if a person, the myth actually says if a person goes to someone's room or their house or goes to a bar, he or she assumes the risk of sexual assault. As if to say, again, similar, what you're wearing that welcomes sexual assault, or you shouldn't have been wearing something so provocative. When we know that, again, this isn't about sex, this is about control. So when you're, you know, explaining this to people who don't maybe have familiarity with, you know, sexual assault, and they're bringing up these ideas of victim blaming, you know, how do you counteract those? What do you tell them?
There's a wonderful little video clip, and I cannot remember the name of the individual that produced it, but it's tea consent, and it's about pouring a glass of tea. And if someone is awake and they say they want tea, you go in and you make the tea, they are under no obligation to drink it when you bring it back. Even if they come to your house one day and say, I want tea, and then choose not to have the tea, it's the same thing. And it's that idea that walking into a person's home does not give that person the right to your body. And it all comes back to consent. Going anywhere doesn't mean someone else can do something to me or to anyone else. And it's hard for some people to understand that, because there's still questions, especially with women, you shouldn't go there. You should have known better. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have been drinking. None of those are a checkbox to say, well, now I can be raped. That's not in any way, shape, or form what it is. But we've got to re-educate people so that they're not thinking that. Because there's a lot of young men who say, well, she came to my room. What does she expect? She expected you to be a gentleman. And when she said no, she expected you to leave her alone. That's what she expected.
Do you still think that a lot of these myths come from a perpetuation of gender roles that we saw in like the, you know, the 30s, 40s, 50s? You're supposed to be a woman. You're supposed to be congenial. You're supposed to be, you know, amiable. And that means that if somebody offers something or if somebody takes you to dinner, that if they expect something in return, that's what you're supposed to do. Do you see that gender roles are perpetuated and that is kind of a foundation of why these things go on? What do you think about that?
I would say that I see that a lot, that gender roles coming out a lot in regards to survivors' experiences of sexual assault and also their experiences of these rape myths. And I often talk about this idea of the just world hypothesis, which is essentially this hypothesis that came out kind of combating things like rape myths, where we want to believe that good things happen to good people. And so if something bad happened, then we have to find a means of saying in our minds, well, maybe, you know, this person did this and that's why this happened. And the fact of the matter is that bad things happen to good people, in that there isn't an explanation, there isn't a justification, there isn't a, you know, there isn't a one way, one word answer that can give this credence that this happened.
Right. So, you know, you were kind of talking before about, you know, this idea of kind of reciprocating somebody's advances, but people can use all sorts of manipulation to be able to further their agenda with sexual assault. And, you know, I think we see this maybe more on a long-term basis, but you see this with sexual assault with children, that they've been groomed. Somebody has kind of in the same way said, well, I've done this for you, or aren't I a nice person? Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, putting this obligation back on their victim of, you should be reciprocating because I've done X, Y, Z. But then, you know, I think it's, some people might push back and say, well, then where do you draw the line? If somebody does something nice to me and then they want to come over to my house, you know, are they thinking in their mind, well, I shouldn't let this go any farther because I'm not interested in them? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, you want to be able to have a platonic situation unfold, but now we're saying that, you know, people are pushing back and saying, well, you should have known better than to let somebody come over to your house. I think there's also this misconception that sexual assault happens only by strangers. So does anybody have statistics as far as what the likelihood is of the perpetrator being somebody that you know?
The last statistics that I saw was from the FBI, and it actually stated that between 8 and 12% are stranger rapes. Most are someone they know.
Oh, wow.
From acquaintance to family members to intimate partners. Mm-hmm. Sexual assault doesn't happen by someone you've never seen before. That is so seldom the crazy person that jumps out of the bushes and drags you into an alley. But that's the myth, that idea of the perfect rape. That's what rape really is. When it's the person who takes you out to dinner, and a lot of young women will feel an obligation. Well, he took me out to dinner. I don't want to seem rude, instead of understanding that she has the right to say no. And then she feels so guilty moving forward. Why didn't I do anything? I didn't really want it, but I didn't tell him no flat out.
Right.
So we need to empower women. We also need to teach young men that women's bodies don't belong to them.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's another myth that, you know, since we're talking about familiarity with the perpetrator, that it's not possible for somebody who's a spouse or a paramour or a partner to sexually assault their partner. Or even this idea that, well, we slept together once, so that means if I wanted to sleep together again, why wouldn't you agree to that? So, you know, there's this idea that it's impossible for somebody who you've been intimate with or have any type of intimate relationship with to sexually assault you. You know, when you're responding to clients who have experienced it with somebody that they're very familiar with or have been intimate with before, you know, what are you telling them? Because I think probably on a certain level, they're questioning, was this really sexual assault?
I mean, for me, one of the biggest things that I like to talk to people about is just the fact that at the end of the day, their body is their own and it always belongs to them. So no matter what kind of relationship or situation that you are in, you know, whether it be a marital situation or a friendship or whatever it may be, mm-hmm. No matter what, your body is not theirs. It is your own. And you have a right to put your foot down and say no at any time you want, even mm-hmm. if, you know, that you have had a sexual relationship up until this point. But if you feel at any point that you don't want it anymore, each person has a right to do that, mm-hmm. no matter their relationship to the perpetrator.
Right. And I think, again, kind of going back, you know, what you've expanded on and what Emily said before, continuous consent throughout an act, because I think it is very possible for somebody to think that they are ready or they want to have an intimate encounter with somebody. And then once it happens, they get a feeling that this isn't what I want after all. And so I think it's, you know, you've gotten the green light. And so all of a sudden they think, well, the green light's the green light. That's the color it's going to be all night. So this is what we're going to do. When, like you said, when it comes down to it, at any point in time, I think this is especially something to impress upon, you know, teenagers, because it can be so hard for them to have that break there on either side, either the one being told no or the one having to say no, that this isn't what I want after all. So, you know, kind of expanding on what you were saying, you know, if you're working with teens and it's just hard to verbalize it, or maybe they feel embarrassed because now they don't want to do it, you know, are you offering anything, you know, beyond, you know, what you just said, as far as, you know, your body is your own? I mean, is there anything that you would say differently to a teenager versus somebody who's an adult?
Usually with our teenagers, they've experienced sexual assault multiple times and don't realize that it's happened to them. And when they do, the sad thing is they feel bad about it. They have questions about it. Very few teenagers who have been in truly consensual relationships come to us later and say, I didn't want to do that. It's the ones who felt there's something off about this. And it's not just telling girls that, yes, please say either yes or no and please speak up, but it's also telling both sides when somebody's not responding anymore, if they're just laying there. When somebody's crying, they don't want to have sex with you. Mm. And I've had young women tell me, I was crying, and he kept going. And he told me later, well, you didn't say no. Mm. Well, she did. She said no very loudly, and you chose to ignore her. So looking at things that make you uncomfortable, recognizing, like Morella said, the right to your own body to say, I don't like this anymore. Yeah, I liked it 3 minutes ago, I don't like it now and I want to stop. And knowing that you'll be respected enough that it does stop. Because very often what we get is, oh, you know you want it, we've gone this far, you still want to do it. It's that pressure, pressure, pressure. And then we get a lot of people being coerced to give in when they didn't really give in. Mm-hmm. So it gets hazy, it gets messy, and it's so hard not only for outsiders to understand what's going on, but for the person who's experienced themselves, was I raped? Was I sexually assaulted? Did I give consent? What does this look like? And then we get arguments that there's false reporting constantly.
Right.
And the level of false reporting is no different for sexual assault than it is for any other felony crime. But the misbelief in the general public, and even with some law enforcement officers, that 50 to 60% of sexual assaults are false reporting. I hear this constantly working with law enforcement all over the state. And that's just not true. There isn't a single study that proves that when you really look into these cases, the false reporting is the same as the false reporting for even homicide, even aggravated battery, and it's less than for grand theft.
Yeah, last week when we were talking about child abuse, we said, you know, it would be better to have, you know, even a handful of reports that ended up being false than to have all of the others go without, you know, our true actual reports being, you know, kind of pushed by the wayside just because people have this idea that there's false reporting that's going on. I know recently there was an article about... some more wonderful decisions from our federal government, where they were going back on the Dear Colleague letter that Obama issued, which some people feel it's making it harder for victims to report on campus. One of the arguments was because of false reporting, you know, we don't want there to be situations where, you know, girls on campus are false reporting. When you read that article, which has everybody taken a glance at that, what was your first reaction when you saw that?
I don't think it can be said on radio what my first reaction actually was. But it was, they don't know what they're talking about, mm-hmm. because this is actually making it much more difficult. It's hard enough to report. The stigma, the questions, the especially if it hits the media, the comments you're going to get are ugly and hateful. Anyone who has the strength to go forward with any type of prosecution of any kind puts themselves in a position of being attacked.
Mm-hmm.
Again, and the revictimization that happens through the courts is extraordinarily difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So this is only making it more difficult for survivors to feel safe, to feel that they have a voice, to feel that they're going to be heard.
Right. Emily, you look like you had something to say.
Well, I think one of the things I continue to think about when I think about the media's view, or when I think about what I'm hearing in the news cycles, or things like that, I'm thinking about how much blame or how much pressure is put on the survivor to verify their story, to explain, this really happened to me. And the fear, no matter what that person's gender, sexual orientation, the fear of, is somebody going to believe me?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a legitimate fear, hearing what that person is hearing in the media from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't be. And I think part of the discussion needs to be not only, sorry, I get really passionate when I talk about this.
No, it's a passionate topic.
But I think one of the things that we're not talking about is, why are we not educating everyone about sexual assault, about consent? Why is, you know, when I go out and do prevention programming, I'm often just asking a simple question. Why are you not asking for consent? And you'll hear messages such as, well, it's awkward, or it's too much pressure for me to like be smooth and be cool and to look like I know what I'm doing. It's a lot of pressure. And my reaction to that is, well, asking is a win-win, because if you ask and the person says no, then you're not hurting them. And if you ask and they say yes, awesome. You're in a consensual sexual situation.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not saying that piece to women, to men, to anybody. We're not having that conversation. And so then the message is, well, then something must, then this person, something must have been wrong, or something, you know, this person did something wrong, or these messages that survivors aren't legitimate are, you know, taken out of proportion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think media, and unfortunately society, sets a bad precedent, because you see, you know, stories come up in the headlines. We have Harvey Weinstein now, who's front and center. And I think the disturbing part of that isn't just the fact that it happened, but that it happened for so long and went unchecked. That you have somebody who was a perpetrator in Hollywood for a very long time. There shouldn't be one victim, but now you have lots of victims. You saw it with Bill Cosby. Again, this was a situation that was perpetrated for a very long time. You have to wonder who was aware of it and was complicit with what he was doing. I think it can be hard when it's somebody you've idolized in any way, shape, or form. You know, Bill Cosby was kind of the all-American dad when he had his show. You look at Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. I don't think people still see that as sexual assault. I think they feel like, well, she was 100% consenting all the time. But we also have more stringent laws against those who are in positions of authority. Mm-hmm. And so, again, you have to look at who is perpetrating these crimes. How are they doing it? I think that that's this is just an opinion, that can be a reason why it's easy for those you're familiar with to perpetrate a crime against you, because it's somebody that you know and somebody you wouldn't expect it from. And so you're not even sure if you're crazy at the moment. Is this really what's going on? Is this person really doing this to me? And so I think, you know, like you were saying, why are we not verbalizing consent? Especially if it is somebody you're familiar with, or if it is really on the up and up, why are you not able to have that verbiage in that situation to say, you know, I'm really into you, I'd like us to do this, and get some feedback at that moment? Because like you said, it's a win-win if it's consensual, and if it's not, at least you know where you stand in the situation. But I think especially when we're trying to educate our youth, this needs to be a practice that they get into, not just assuming, well, you're my girlfriend or you're my boyfriend, so this is what's going to happen. I think we've unfortunately seen that if we're not educating the right, you know, first step of verbalizing consent, you open a complete Pandora's box of this being a continual issue. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I would just like to add to that, going back to some of the things we've talked about with gender norms and... I do think that more work needs to be done among males of holding other males accountable. Of course, being mindful that there's lots of different variants as far as gender in terms of these issues we're discussing, but there are a majority of male perpetrators, and I think there's a larger culture where men feel entitled to women's bodies, and that it really needs to be addressed. And this, the focus of talking about these issues so often becomes an issue of, well, how do women stop this from happening to them, when we need to really also talk about men need to stop doing this and shift the focus to perpetrators not perpetrating, as opposed to how do people protect themselves against it, as though it's an assumption that it will take place.
Right, yeah.
And can I just say, too, when it comes to education, another thing that I think is important is to talk about what kind of relationship sexual assault can happen. Because I think oftentimes when we think about it, we think about, you know, how we talked about before, we think it's sex. And so it's a sexual, you know, exchange between two people. And so it's this probably happens, right, with people who are dating or in relationships. But, you know, we see a sexual assault in all sorts of situations. So if you look at individuals with disabilities, you know, the huge range of ability that these individuals have, some of them are completely nonverbal. You know, some people with disabilities are verbal, but just thinking about that population, you know, we think about children population, the elderly population, different people that have caregivers, and thinking about the fact that sexual assault can happen in all of these different forms of relationship.
Right.
It doesn't just have to be a romantic sexual relationship or friendship or whatever between two people.
Yeah, that's a very good example. Kind of moving into domestic violence, because I think these two have a lot of underlying issues. You know, one of the things that people kind of talk about is that domestic violence is cyclical, that, you know, if you're a child who grows up in a home that has domestic violence, you eventually become the perpetrator or you become a victim, because this is what your norm is now. You've grown up in a house of chaos. But again, to kind of go back to the very first step, when we were talking about sexual assault, how do you define domestic violence? Because I think a lot of people, you know, kind of what we were saying, you have to have bruises. You have to have something that shows that you're an actual victim. But I think we're completely aware that there's multiple ways for somebody to be abused, especially by their partner.
Domestic violence is a pattern of behavior that attempts to exert power and control over another individual, usually one that is in a family or intimate partner relationship. It takes the form of financial, sexual, physical, emotional, and psychological abuse. And I would actually add another one now, which is technology, the use of technology to abuse. It is about power and control. It's not about care or respect or loving. It's about making that person do, be, or act the way you want them to.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way of defining it. Again, I think we see relationships and we think, you know, this has to be consensual. If you're a victim, then you're a victim by choice. You know, why are you staying with somebody who's abusing you? You're completely aware of what they're capable of. But again, I think we need to correct that and help people understand. On average, if anybody has a statistic to share, how many times does a victim have to attempt to leave their partner before they're successfully able to do it?
7 to 12.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. Yeah. And to think that each time they leave, that can kind of up the ante, where the abuser may be even more abusive and escalate because you have attempted to circumvent their control over you. And so now I have to show you how much control I have and why you can't leave. I had a friend who was, this was several years ago, but it was my first kind of opening moment about what domestic violence really was. Her partner had basically explained that if you ever try to leave me, I will kill our children. Mm-hmm. It was just a very blanket statement, one that he made after she attempted to leave for the fourth time. And he felt like that was the only control he had left to assert over her, mm-hmm. was the children. You know, he'd taken away money. He'd isolated her from friends, you know, done all the typical steps that an abuser would do. But she had, you know, dared to stand up for herself. And that was the only way that he had to, you know, to fire back on her. But when we, you know, when you're, you know, they say you go to work with your coworkers and maybe you never understand what's completely happening behind doors, you know, again, with sexual assault and things like that. You know, is there any way to tell if somebody is a victim of domestic violence?
On the surface, not necessarily. There are some things that you might see if you've known someone for a while. Some of the things like she quits doing, or he quits doing things that they've always done before, like outside activities. If they were on a softball team, they're not on it anymore. Mm-hmm. Their appearance has changed. If they're out with the other individual, they tend to cut their eyes to them before they answer questions. Mm. The other person is always playfully, and I say that with quotes around it, playfully putting them down, but they're constantly being insulted, even in a joking manner, which can be a form of abuse, especially in the way the person reacts to it. But victims and abusers, we know them. We all know them. We see them every day, and we have no idea, especially with batterers, that that's who that person is. Often working in the court system, I'm one of the few people in the domestic violence program that sees batterers every day as a court advocate. And when we take a victim in to help her get an order of protection, she's usually there by herself. The batterer has an attorney and his parents and a religious leader and his boss and his new girlfriend and all these people talking about how great he is, because there's two sides. There's a Jekyll and Hyde. They're very good at making everyone else believe that they're great people, and that the victim is the one to blame. And they will tell you, I'm the victim in this case. She did these terrible things to me. Mm-hmm. So many people are taken in by the batterer's behavior, and they truly believe that he's this marvelous person and she's this wretched human being, mm-hmm. when it's actually the other way around. And not saying that men can't be victims, because they can't.
Right.
But approximately 85% of perpetrators are male and 15% are female.
Yeah, just kind of sharing my own personal experience. Last year, I had to get an order of protection against my ex. I was pregnant at the time, and when we broke up, he decided to escalate things to an unsafe place. And I felt like, if you're doing this while I'm pregnant, I have no idea what you're going to do when I'm not. The part that surprised me, and I had some great support with that from like the Women's Center on the U of I campus. But when I went in front of the judge and he made his final decision, he said, I do feel like you are partly to blame for this, and the only reason why I'm issuing this is because you're pregnant. And I just kind of sat there in disbelief. Of course, I didn't say anything because we're in a courtroom, and I didn't want to fuel the fire of him thinking I was crazy. But I remember talking to a friend afterwards when I was just kind of in this, you know, you're in this moment of, did I just hear what I think I heard from, and you know, somebody who's sitting on the bench who's supposed to be here to protect victims? And then I thought, no wonder it's hard for people to come forward and try to protect themselves when this is the kind of mentality that we see in the courthouse, which is supposed to be where they go to seek protection. Just incredibly appalled by that judge's behavior that day. I think there's ways that we have to start changing the climate of this. When I was in D.C. last year at the NASW National Conference, one of the sessions in the evening was documentaries. I attended one called Finding Jen's Voice, which was about murder being the number one killer of pregnant women. The Jen in Finding Jen's Voice was a woman who had had an extramarital affair with a man, and essentially having his child was going to complicate his life extremely. One of the people I actually met while I was down there was Kate. Are you still there, Kate?
Yeah, I am. Hi.
Okay. Thank you for hanging in there. Sure. But again, a very compelling story. I would love for you to share, you know, a bit about your story, you know, why you were featured, and then, you know, how this has helped you build and become who you are now, because you're an amazing activist now.
Sure. So I'm actually coming up on the 5th, and I hate to call it anniversary, of my shooting. My ex-husband actually shot me twice and my father twice in front of our child, our then 4-year-old son. So that was the culmination, actually, of almost 2 years of me trying to get away from him and divorce him and keep, you know, myself and my family and my son safe. The thing with my story is that, and I, you know, I've been listening the whole time, and I know a lot of young women don't know about the various forms of abuse and things like that. But I mean, I was 34 when I met my abuser, and I can say that I pretty much went through much of my adult life without knowing really anything about the various forms of abuse. Basically, growing up, I mean, the way we were told is if a guy hits you, that's abuse. But no, we didn't know about, we weren't told about emotional abuse and financial abuse and psychological, a little bit about verbal. He shouldn't, you know, talk nasty to you. But I had basically every form of coercive control and abuse that somebody could possibly have, minus the physical. We had one altercation, which was what sent me out the door, and he actually did not hit me in that altercation. He threatened to, but he didn't actually go through with it. So really the only physical portion of that entire story was the actual shooting. So the most important thing is to educate people on, you know, the various forms of abuse and what those signs look like, because I didn't have the tools. I wasn't equipped. I didn't know what to look for. It never even actually occurred to me that somebody would purposefully manipulate and control me and gaslight me and, get me into this place where it's like I didn't even recognize myself anymore. So I, post-shooting, have been active in the fight against domestic and gun violence, obviously because I know the dangerous intersection between domestic and gun violence. So a big part of my advocacy is making sure and trying to work hard to ensure that domestic abusers are disarmed, because honestly, a lot of the gun violence in this country is happening within families. These men are armed, and when they're losing power and control, they're coming in and shooting their wives and children and then themselves, and that's a mass shooting right there. So anyway, that's been a big part of my advocacy.
So, you know, you heard us talking about the different myths with sexual assault, and there are equally a great number of myths when it comes to domestic violence, including what constitutes domestic violence. But I think another, you know, issue is that you should be able to see it coming. So, you know, if somebody says, well, you should have gotten out of there before your husband shot you, you know, there's no way of, you know, from your perspective especially, you know, what can you say to people who act like you had a crystal ball, that you knew that this was going to escalate to this point?
Oh, yes. I've been in this fight for about 5 years, and victim blaming has definitely been a part of my journey. And the thing that I, the biggest issue I would say is that with coercive control, I kind of like, and it's kind of like water torture. Like, it's just, it's very slow, like drip, drip, drip over time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you get sucked into this web and you don't even recognize it for what it is. Within 2 years of being with him, it was a very short relationship. Everything escalated very quickly. But the level of power and control was something that I didn't recognize. And it is a myth. I mean, you should have recognized that these guys aren't waving their abuser flag when they're first getting together with you. They have their mask up, that their mask is up, and it takes a little time for that mask to come down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think getting rid of those myths has to do with educating people about the signs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know this was more of an emotional reaction, but when my ex and I broke up, I said he was a textbook sociopath.
Mine too, yeah.
And you see it on social media here, the 10 reasons to see if somebody is a sociopath. Well, that's not exactly how it plays out, obviously.
No.
There is a resource online, the Power and Control Wheel, that people can reference if they want to have a better idea of what this looks like. It gives you a good explanation of the different areas of abuse that you can have. For instance, we've talked about using economic abuse. It doesn't speak to technology yet, but I assume that this will get updated at some point, because that is very much a part of abuse now. Mm-hmm. I had a friend.
Well, and I would say that the movie that you were referencing when you introduced me, Finding Jen's Voice, is probably one of the most comprehensive documentaries that I've seen as far as educating people about what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm in it, and every time I go to a screening and I'm on a panel and I watch it, I learn something new each time, and I've been through it. So, I mean, there are resources out there.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, kind of what you guys, the panel in-house tonight was saying, you know, even sexual assault, we're looking at people defining it on their own terms. And we have to be able to validate those definitions, because what is domestic violence to one person may not be to another. It's just, you know, perception is reality. So how are you perceiving what's being done to you? And if you, you know, we're speaking about any type of manipulation or control, you know, if you're defining that as domestic violence, again, we should be validating and listening to that and taking it seriously, because I think we can hear that when, you know, police are called out to a scene and we're talking about domestic violence. Well, I would really be appalled if I ever heard anybody say this, but if anybody's even, you know, skirting the line of, well, what did you do to make this happen tonight? Again, you're perpetrating this idea that the victim has done something to deserve it, because they're not, well, if you just follow the rules, you know, again, like Morella was saying, it's still your body. It's still your life. You still get to make your own rules, and somebody else should not be dictating to you what happens to you. I think that alone by itself is a way to define what's happening to you. Gaslighting, I know, is something that a lot of abusers use. Well, this isn't really sexual assault, or this isn't really domestic violence. You're just making this up in your head. So again, you know, I think that's another way to keep people under control, is to make them feel like they're crazy for even assuming that what's happening to them is inappropriate. Yeah, definitely, if people have a chance to watch Finding Jen's Voice, it's an amazing documentary. Kate is in the documentary and shares her story in a very, very powerful way. But just want to get to a couple more myths before we close up the show tonight. I think there's this idea that there's a certain demographic that both sexual assault and domestic violence happen to. There's this idea that it's minorities or it's people who are in poverty. I think somebody mentioned it earlier. You know, Morella, you talked about the different scenarios that it can happen in. So obviously victims are across the board. Is that what you're seeing in the work that you do, is that this is not just one demographic?
Absolutely. Interestingly, in our work, because we're a non-for-profit, most of the people that we do see will be lower income. Higher income people, even when isolated, have other resources. And they don't; those other resources often don't have to keep statistics. We do. So if you look just at statistics of who comes in, it looks like this skewed lower income level, when that's not true at all. It's across the board from every socioeconomic group, every religious group, every community. It doesn't matter where you're from. It's approximately 1 in 4 relationships are abusive relationships.
That's a staggering number. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of what you're seeing on campus also? Is that this is not just one background or demographic we're looking at?
Yeah, I think that's the national statistic. So if you look at organizations, if you look at the Department of Justice and the statistics they're putting out, that is equivalent to what we're seeing across the board in counseling centers, in community resources, in private practices, that's what's seen because that's the national statistic.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, before we close up the show, if everybody can just speak a little bit about the organization that you're coming from, what services you provide, how you can help both victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, that way we can promote resources for those who really need them. We'll start over here with Courage Connection.
Okay, so Courage Connection is an agency that provides domestic violence services. We have housing services, so we have an emergency shelter, which is a 45-day shelter. Our hotline you can call at 384-4390, and that is how you get hooked up with our emergency shelter. We also have a one-year transitional housing program. And then we also provide a number of services that you don't have to live there residentially, so anybody in the community can access them, and that is all our legal services.
Which are amazing,
which Lisa is the head of, as well as our counseling services, and those are open to anybody. And we do also offer some rental assistance, and we own some properties around the community that we can offer at as low of a rate of rent as we can.
Okay.
Yep. And we will come out and we will do talks and educational talks about domestic violence to anybody in the community that is interested and willing to have us.
One last thing, we do have a fabulous thrift store that the proceeds go back into supporting our services for our clients, which is out at Lincoln Square called Connections.
Awesome.
So Emily and myself are coming from the University of Illinois Counseling Center, so we are unfortunately limited to the students who are there, but we provide a variety of counseling services to students, both individual and group counseling. We also have services that specialize in areas such as substance abuse, trauma, eating disorders, etc. So that's where we're coming from, and there are other resources in the larger community that I'd encourage people to look into as well.
The Counseling Center also does prevention programming and outreach programming, and so students on campus or staff members can request for us to come out and talk with students or share our thoughts about, you know, different aspects of what we do. So Tom was talking about substance use, trauma, wellness, things like that. We come out and we'll talk to people.
Wonderful. So thank you guys for being on the show tonight. We just scratched the surface about these different topics. We'll be having other shows where we expand on a lot of the different areas within these topics.
We'd love to come back.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you, Kate, for calling in from D.C. and sharing your story. Of course, you'll be welcomed as a guest to, you know, keep sharing what's gone on with you and the work that you've done since then. This show is archived. We've been live streaming, if everybody want to wave to Facebook land. Both the video and the audio recording will be archived on my Facebook page. You can also catch it on RadioFreeAmerica.com under WEFT. It's also on my Tumblr blog at InTheKnow217. Tune in next week. We'll be discussing bullying. We'll have Dr. Dorothy Espelage, a former faculty at the U of I, and Jonathan Westfield, a CPD officer who's offered this type of programming throughout the community. Thank you again, everybody, for coming out. Stay tuned. We have wonderful additional programming coming in after In the Know. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
You tell me it gets better in time. You say to pull myself together, pull it together, you'll be fine. Tell me what the hell do you know? What do you know? Tell me how the hell.